case of the day, Lindsay Gostel versus Curtis Strand, 20AP1943. Could I please start?
Sorry. I had to turn it off before.
All right. All right. Good afternoon. As I understand it, the lineup is 25 minutes, followed by 5 minutes, or 30 minutes, followed by 5 minutes in rebuttal. Is that your understanding as well? Great. Let's proceed.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Mackenzie Campbell. As I introduced myself earlier, I am representing Lindsay Gostel in this dispute against State Farm Fire and Casualty Company. The issue in this case is whether a criminal conviction for second-degree reckless homicide can preclude claims of a victim who was not a party to the prior criminal proceeding in this subsequent negligent action. The Court of Appeals and Circuit Court decisions should be reversed for three reasons. The first is that issue preclusion cannot be applied in this case as a matter of law. The second is that Strand's criminal conviction for second-degree reckless homicide does not preclude a finding of occurrence under the State Farm policy. And lastly, the intentional acts exclusion in that State Farm policy does not apply as a matter of law. With respect to the first issue, issue preclusion, this is a doctrine that has evolved throughout our jurisprudence, but essentially requires two elements be met in order for it to be applied in any given case. It is grounded in foundations of due process, which requires a fair opportunity procedurally, substantively, and evidentiarily before it can be applied. And the issue in this case, probably the biggest issue, is that the Court of Appeals decision and the Circuit Court opinion do not apply that threshold inquiry of due process as to whether or not there is a sufficient identity of interest between Ms. Gostel and the prosecution in the underlying criminal case so as to apply issue preclusion to her in this case. That is a threshold inquiry from the Ryle case that we know that if it is not met, issue preclusion cannot be applied to the case.
Can you just help me out, counsel, with the Court of Appeals didn't really talk about this area at all. Why not? I didn't go back, or I don't recall. Was this briefed to them in any way? I just want to figure out kind of how we got to from here, there to here.
It was not briefed. The original motion that was filed by State Farm at the circuit court level sought preclusion and used that word preclusion, but the doctrine of issue preclusion was not argued at the circuit court or the appellate level. But central to both the circuit court's determination and the Court of Appeals was always, what is the preclusive effect of the criminal conviction of second-degree reckless homicide? I know that there has been an argument that we have waived this argument, and I will address it head-on. This court, even if it's waived, has the discretion to consider any waived argument, and really should in this case. Two main reasons. The first is that, like I said, issue preclusion, or the preclusive effect, rather, of the criminal conviction has been central to this dispute from the very first brief that was filed up until now, and has been the focus of the party's briefing and discussion, even though they have not used the term issue preclusion. But more importantly, this is a published precedential Court of Appeals opinion on the doctrine of issue preclusion. And the problem with that is that we have precedent set forth in Page and the progeny of that case that sets forth this due process requirement. And if this decision is allowed to stand without being reversed, if it is allowed to continue and become precedential law, that due process requirement, that threshold inquiry, is removed. and it's allowed.
No, counsel. I mean, what about Jensen? Talk to me about Jensen. That's where defensive use of issue preclusion was set out and affirmed.
Yes, it was set out and affirmed. But one of the distinctions between Jensen and this case, among many, is the relationship between the plaintiffs and Jensen. They were husband and wife. They had this special relationship that's talked about in both the restatements and in the case law. But more importantly, in Jensen, we actually have facts in the Jensen record that tell us she not only participated in that underlying proceeding, she had a sufficient identity of interest with her husband, and that she had a stake in the financial outcome of that case. And really what Jensen tells us is, look, we're not going to allow you to have a second bite at the apple when you could have and should have participated with your husband in that case. And so we're not going to allow you to do that here. So it did conduct the threshold due process inquiry, but it came to a different result.
Right.
But really what guides us in this case is actually the Page case.
Well, it did find an identity of interest between the person initially started with and the person then in the, you know, in the second case, in the second part of the Jensen case.
Yes.
Okay. So you wanted, I'm sorry, you wanted to talk about another case. What one do you think is more important than Jensen and why?
The Page case. The Page case is determinative of the outcome of this case. It is, you know, it's offensive use of issue preclusion, but it tells us what's important. Because at paragraph 33 of the Page opinion, this court outlines a list of things it found to be dispositive of that threshold due process inquiry. What sorts of things do we need to look at to make sure that that procedural, substantive, and evidentiary due process has been met? And what's interesting about the Page case, although the facts of the case are horrific, we look at the claim that was brought by the mother against the grandparents of the father who had been convicted of first-degree sexual assault of his children. The court said, you know what, no, we are not going to allow you to apply issue preclusion in this case because the grandparents never had an opportunity to litigate these issues. They never had an opportunity to present evidence. They never had an opportunity to cross-examine or examine witnesses. They never had an opportunity to participate in strategy. And that's really important in this case, because the underlying issue for coverage is what is the injury-causing event. And Ms. Dostal, just like the grandparents in the Page case, she never had an opportunity to call witnesses. She never had an opportunity to examine or cross-examine them. She never had an opportunity to present expert testimony on the threshold issue of what is the injury-causing event. And she never had an opportunity to participate in that action other than a witness.
So is your argument that if we find in your favor on this threshold due process inquiry, then as a matter of law, you win on the issue preclusion issue?
Yes.
Okay.
As a matter of law, what? I didn't hear the last.
I'm sorry. I said then as a matter of law, do you win on the issue preclusion issue?
And my answer was yes.
And then you listed two other reasons, the it's not an occurrence and the intentional exclusion does not apply. Do we need to get to those then, or do we just stop?
No, you don't need to get to those, as long as you find on the issue preclusion issue, you put it. But even if you wanted to go through those things, it doesn't matter. But I do want to mention one other thing about the issue preclusion issue, because that's prejudice. And it's not something that's necessarily discussed in the cases, but it's something I alluded to in the waiver, and that there are people behind these cases, there are victims behind these cases, and they come to the doors of justice to have those claims heard, have those claims adjudicated. And when issue preclusion is asserted against them without that due process inquiry, that door of justice is slammed in their face before they get one foot inside.
I'm not understanding anything why waiver's even an issue here. It's the State Farm who's saying issue preclusion applies, and they've said it all along as far as I can tell.
Correct.
So that's the main issue that we have to deal with, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. I do want to touch briefly on the other two issues that I raised, and that is the Circuit Court's ruling and the Court of Appeals ruling as to whether or not the criminal conviction could prevent the existence of an occurrence under the State Farm policy. And the reason why I want to touch on those issues is because what's unique about this case is that we know that the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals relied almost exclusively, if not exclusively, on the criminal jury instruction and the conviction in making its decision. But what's interesting is what those decisions said in addition to that. At Plaintiff's Appendix, page 120, the Circuit Court ruling noted that the issue here comes down to whether the defendant's criminal conviction allows this court to find that there's an occurrence despite disputed underlying facts, acknowledging that there is an existence of disputed fact with respect to the injury-causing event. Similarly, the Court of Appeals opinion at the Plaintiff's Appendix, page 104, acknowledges that there's a dispute of facts and that Mr. Strand's version of events in the underlying criminal trial was always that his daughter fell. He gave two different versions of events, but it was always that his daughter fell. The experts in that criminal trial...
Wasn't that set aside by the experts' opinion that the jury must have bought or they would not have convicted him?
No, what the experts testified to was that she could not have fallen from a height, as he described it. She could not have sustained an injuries from the height that he described it. But they never said it couldn't occur from a fall. And actually, they did testify that a skull fracture could occur from a fall, but they couldn't say exactly what happened. And so there's a dispute between what he says happened and the experts saying, look, it couldn't have happened exactly the way that he said, still could have been a fall.
Did he testify at trial?
He did not.
You just have statements that he made before trial that were read into the record, and that's it?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. He did not testify at the criminal trial.
Okay.
Counsel, can I just ask a quick question? I just want to go back. You were talking about a threshold due process issue.
Yes.
And I just missed that. I'm not sure exactly what you're referring to. I thought you kind of made, you know, two arguments in your brief, the issue preclusion and then there actually being, you know, coverage under the terms of the policy. I just want to make sure I'm not missing an argument that you're making.
No, the threshold due process inquiry is step one of the issue preclusion analysis. I like to say it's can it be applied and should it be applied?
Right.
Step one, two. Can it be applied refers to that due process consideration when the party against whom issue preclusion is sought is a non-party in the prior proceeding.
Right. Okay. Yeah, that's the, was it actually litigated, you know, and was there sort of privity? You're just calling that the threshold due process inquiry.
Correct.
Okay, got it. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the standard of law here ordinarily on issue preclusion is, normally we're reviewing, it's a little different procedural posture, but the first part is a question of law.
Correct.
Then there's the fundamental fairness aspect, which is a discretionary determination.
Some of the fundamental fairness factors, such as whether they could be joined in the underlying actions, are questions of law.
Yeah.
And some of them, you're right, are discretionary determinations.
Right. But maybe this gets to what Justice Kurofsky was saying, but no. Obviously, if we don't think there was, if we think you're correct on the first part of the inquiry, that sort of settles the matter on the issue preclusion. Right. Yeah.
Correct. You do not need to go into the fundamental fairness factors.
Right.
Correct. But with respect to the occurrence, I want to hammer on this because this is what is one of the main reasons why this decision should be reversed with respect to the occurrence issue, is that on summary judgment or declaratory judgment, that circuit court is required to consider all of the facts in the record when making a decision. And the circuit court and court of appeals here limited the set of facts that it considered on this motion to just the criminal conviction and the jury instruction when there are competing facts that require a different outcome. And they acknowledge the existence of those facts, but nevertheless rely on the criminal conviction. And reckless conduct is not intentional conduct. And what is so striking in this case to me is if you set aside the criminal recklessness instruction and you put it right next to the civil negligence instruction, they are almost word for word identical.
Well, there's a significant difference, though, counsel, isn't there? Because in the jury instruction for second-degree reckless homicide, it's that the defendant was aware. So that's a subjective consideration. Negligence is what a reasonable person
would recognize that's an objective standard. Can you address the significance of that distinction between the two?
I don't actually find that to be a significant difference, because at the end of the day, in a trial, we have to find that the civil defendant acted in a way that was unreasonable themselves in order for them to be liable. And so, no, I don't think that's a significant difference that requires a different outcome in this case.
Well, I find it significant because going further with it, with respect to second-degree reckless homicide, the state was required to prove, and it did prove, the defendant was aware that his conduct created the unreasonable and substantial risk of death or great bodily harm. So there is, the state had to prove that there was an awareness of the consequences of the conduct that the defendant engaged in.
Yes.
You don't find that significant?
I don't find it significant to the result, both because of the issue preclusion issue, and also because even in a civil negligence case, we have to prove that someone acted not in accordance as a reasonable person would, meaning there's this awareness of the risk and they ignored it. So from a practical standpoint, yes, there is a word, but I do think it's distinction without a difference in this particular case.
Can you address the restatement?
With respect to...
I don't think you spent a lot of time on that. I think it was the Waj brief that actually talked about it, the amicus. It seems like this issue's already been resolved in other jurisdictions, right? By looking at the restatement and that example in terms of the privity, in terms of the issue of what... We're going back to issue preclusion, but whether or not a criminal case is binding on a victim of that case who later brings a civil suit.
Correct. It is. And the restatement does rely on that, and the Page case talks about the restatement all over the place. That's why the Page case is dispositive of this issue, because we never get past that threshold inquiry of the first step of the required analysis. So yes, you're right. The result of the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals is inconsistent with the restatement, and it's inconsistent with Page, which is existing precedent in this state of Wisconsin for many, many years now. I want to briefly touch on the intentional acts exclusion as well, so I touch on all of the arguments that I said I would. But this is an argument that was raised that the court doesn't need to address unless we are not successful in the issue preclusion piece, but I do want to touch on it briefly because it was mentioned in the Circuit Court's decision. It was not mentioned in the Court of Appeals decision, so it was not a basis on the Court of Appeals. However, because it is important to the determination of summary judgment in favor of State Farm, I want to address it here. And what the lower courts had said is the issue preclusion based on his criminal conviction, because they inferred intent as a matter of law. And this is a big deal, again, because I just went through how similar the negligence instruction and the criminal reckless instruction are. And so when we're talking about specifically coverage, meaning an occurrence, and then an exclusion, we know that two different elements have to be met in order to infer intent. And that's the KAG by Carson versus Stanford case. First, the conduct has to be intentional, and the conduct must be substantially certain to cause injury. But it's a little more nuanced than that, and that's in the Loveridge case. And it talks about that insured's conviction of a crime gives rise to an inference that the insured intended to injure as a matter of law only in two situations. And again, intended to injure as a matter of law. And the first one is if intent to injure is an element of the crime, and I think we all agree that it's not an element of second-degree criminal recklessness. And two, if the crime in question involves the insured's committing an intentional act that carries with it a substantial risk of injury or death. And the issue in this case is that the crime involves an intentional act. And again, recklessness is not intent. The jury specifically disregarded the first degree charge of criminal reckless homicide. The jury disregarded that and found him guilty of second degree.
But that But that just, that's just an utter disregard for human life element.
Correct.
Wait, what verdicts went to the jury? And a first-degree intentional, a first-degree intentional homicide?
No.
First-degree
criminal
reckless
homicide, yes.
Right. Which also does not have an intent element. The only difference between first-degree reckless and second-degree reckless is the utter disregard for human life element.
It is an utter disregard, but neither of those have the intentional element that's necessary from the Loveridge case. So there's been no finding of intent to either act or injure on either of these things. And what I found to be interesting in this particular case, and specifically as it related to this particular argument, as a trial attorney, we have to bring a case and say that the defendant was negligent, meaning that they had a disregard of ordinary care. And it's very often that we get up in front of a jury and the defense argument is that this is just an unfortunate accident, but there's no culpability, there's no liability, because in that instance, they're not liable at all. So there has to be negligence for them to be liable. But what they're really saying here, at least in State Farm's argument, is that they're not going to be liable ever, because they're inferring intent in a situation that is almost exactly the same as a negligence case. And so for that reason, given the criminal conviction that he was convicted of and issue preclusion, we cannot infer intent as a matter of law in this case. So for those reasons, I would ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision and the Circuit Court ruling, apply Page to this case, and not allow the expansion of Page beyond what has been contemplated by the principles of due process. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel?
Following the instructions of the deputy here.
Good idea.
That's what I understood. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Bill Moran, and I'm here on behalf of State Farm, along with my colleague, Maya Degre. there's a lot to unpack here with regard to the arguments now advanced by counsel for Ms. Dostal. No one is arguing that this wasn't a terrible tragedy. It certainly was. The issue that really is at the center of this, whether or not an occurrence actually was established or could be established under the evidence of the case. In this matter, the Circuit Court, as well as the Court of Appeals, reviewed the record, reviewed the information, and this was a direct action that was being pursued Dostal against State Farm, along with a liability act, Mr. Strand. And in that circumstance, there was a bifurcation and stay motion that was made in order to advance the analysis with regard to the insurance coverage issues. So the liability case was stayed. During the course of that process, and there or can then look outside the four corners of the complaint, and this was a summary judgment motion, in order to determine whether or not there is evidence to support the conclusion as to whether or not coverage was triggered in this case. The Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals uniformly found that the conviction of Mr. Strand for second-degree reckless homicide was not an accident, and as a result of not being an accident, it could not be an occurrence. And because it could not be an occurrence, you don't ever get into the coverage analysis.
Counsel, I want to talk about the restatement a little bit, which, again, we're not the first court to have addressed this question. And the restatement of judgments, section 85. There's a comment F, and then there's an illustration, illustration number 10. And I'd like to get your response to that, if you just think it's wrong or if I'm misreading it. But I just want to get us on the same page. It posits an intentional homicide. D inflicts a blow on X. X dies. D is convicted of intentional homicide. The administrator of X's estate brings an action for wrongful death, alleging negligence on the part of the D, who had just been, again, convicted of intentional homicide. There's policy of liability insurance, insuring for negligent acts, but excluding intentional acts. And according to the restatements, again, summary of the general law in this area, this is not excluded. The administrator of the estate can bring the action to show that. So I guess I'd like to get your response to that, because that's a more extreme version of this case. It seems that you're advocating for something that would run contrary to this, which, of course, we're not bound by the restatement. I know that. We can disagree with the restatement and have on occasion, but I want to know your response to this.
Absolutely. And at first blush, when you do read through that, your instincts are correct. There was a criminal conviction, and that's not going to bind a plaintiff in another case to preclude that person from trying to prove negligence. However, the major distinction we have here, and that's not part of this restatement 85, is that this is direct action. And there was a determination by the trial court in response to arguments raised both by Ms. Dostal and Mr. Strand in the circuit court that there was coverage. And that argument was rejected. And in a direct action case, and as we know, and I think it's the case, I don't want to mispronounce it, but it's the Kranchuk case, I believe, talks about how the direct action state or how the direct action statute interplays with circumstances such as this. And in that case, there's a specific distinction that's drawn, saying in a direct action circumstance, the plaintiff who is pursuing the coverage has no greater rights than the defendant does. And the defendant, tortfeasor, in this case, is Mr. Strand. And so the folly of the argument that somehow or other, and again, this goes to this privity issue, which is really, I think, the focus of now couched in terms of due process, but this is really what we're talking about, and that's what the illustration in 85 talks about, is the privity to the underlying criminal conviction, is there. Because Ms. Dostal cannot take anything greater from an insurance policy than Mr. Strand can for this unfortunate circumstance.
What do you base that on?
It's in the Kranchuk case as well as the direct action statute.
Okay.
Could you spell that out?
Yeah, I don't understand what you're tracking. Saying.
Okay. Kranzush case. I'll read to you the statement that was made by the Court of Appeals in the Kranzush case. It says, Section 63.24, Wisconsin statutes, the direct action statute. This section makes an insurer liable up to policy limits to the persons entitled to recover against the insured for the death of any person or for injury to persons or property. While it is no doubt true, as the petitioner suggests, that this section is intended to facilitate recovery by injured parties, it is clear from the language of the statute that the liability to which the insurer is exposed is liability of the insured. And what is being advanced in this case is that if Mr. Strand, who did make a claim for insurance coverage in this case, is told, no, you are precluded from pursuing your claim for insurance coverage because it was not an accident and it is not an occurrence and it doesn't fall within the trigger of coverage, Ms. Dostal doesn't have any greater rights to seek recovery of insurance. And that's essentially what the Court of Appeals and the circuit court has observed in this. And for those reasons, when we talk about privity and we talk about the issue of due process, when you're talking about issue preclusion, you have to look at what the net effect is. What rights? Ms. Dostal is a stranger to that insurance policy. She is not an insured of State Farm. Mr. Strand is. And that's the logic behind the direct action statute. It is designed to be a facilitator to have direct claims made against insurance companies, but then it is limited by the terms of that policy. And so to the extent that it is determined that Mr. Strand engaged in conduct that was not an accident, which was what happened here, which is precisely what happened here with regard to that criminal conviction, if it's not an accident, Ms. Dostal can't recover under the insurance policy because it's not an accident.
Okay, I understand what you're saying if it's not an accident, but what you're really, how does issue preclusion play into this? Because Ms. Dostal is not Mr. Strand. She is not in privity. Do you agree that she's not in privity with
him? No, I think by operation of the direct action statute, she is in privity.
You think the statute imposes privity on her?
Absolutely.
And you cite to that which case? What's the cite?
It's Kranzush versus Badger State Mutual Insurance Casualty or Mutual Casualty Company, 103 Wisconsin 2nd, 56, 1981.
This is discussed on page 15 of State Farm's brief.
Correct.
So the last page of your brief, that's where you put this argument?
No, Your Honor. It's not the last page of our brief.
Page 15 of 36.
Oh, I'm looking at this the
for
other
the record.
Brief. Sorry, I didn't. I'm going to have to go back and read this case because I still don't see how that applies, but that's obviously on me.
Well, I can give you a hypothetical. I'll give you a hypothetical to kind of...
I interrupt
sure.
before you go to hypotheticals?
Sure.
Because I think we can apply it to this situation, right?
Sure.
I just want to make sure I'm understanding your argument. Mr. Strand is the insured under this policy, not Ms. Dostal, correct?
Correct.
But the direct action statute allows Ms. Dostal to make a claim directly against the insurance company.
Correct.
She is not a party to the contract, correct?
Correct.
So in that respect, she stands in the shoes of the insured, Mr. Strand, and could recover only those insurance benefits that Mr. Strand would be entitled to, but he is, I hate to use the word precluded, but he is precluded from claiming that there was an accident because a jury criminally convicted him.
Correct.
So as I'm understanding it, it is then State Farm's conclusion that because Mr. Strand could not recover under the policy, Ms. Dostal cannot.
Correct.
Thank you.
And the court determined that Mr. Strand could not recover under the policy. The circuit court determined that was not appealed. And so Ms. Strand brought it up claiming that she was entitled to at least test the waters with regard to this issue of negligence. And at the end of the day, now that Mr. Strand does not have any coverage, I don't see how Ms. Dostal can revive that and make a claim that she is entitled to coverage that would then be limited and focus exclusively on the conduct of Mr. Strand. Because as we saw in the charge to the jury, and one of the arguments that was raised by counsel on behalf of Ms. Dostal was that there were no findings of fact with regard to these issues at the criminal court level. And as a result, there has to be an opportunity to test the facts and determine whether or not there is negligence. And that's precise, and with all due respect to counsel, that's precisely what the jury did do.
They didn't do that. And they only heard two statements from Mr. Strand, which he gave to the police. And both of those, if you read them, I might have dropped her, or she might have fallen off of a table. I mean, those certainly sound like things that happened accidentally. There was no evidence introduced, and whether or not the jury, you know, found that there was enough evidence to convict him of reckless homicide because the state was able with experts and other people to prove to prove the elements of reckless homicide and to prove that that he created an unreasonable and substantial risk of death and that he was aware of it is one thing. But as far as what actually happened, that wasn't tried.
It was tried. And it was tried through those statements, and it was tried through forensic analysis performed by experts who testified at the time of the trial. And a jury heard all that evidence and determined not only did the conduct of Mr. Strand create a substantial likelihood of a certain likelihood of severe harm to Haven, but also that he was aware of it. And that awareness is what takes this out of the realm of being an accident at that point. It removes it from that because
So you don't think that it's possible for someone to act in a reckless manner and hurt someone in an accident? That's what
I am saying is that if we focus on the evidence and on the jury charge, and there was no challenge, there was an opportunity for Mr. Strand to appeal his conviction, and he did not. But if you look at what the jury charge specifically said.
Yeah, I got the jury instruction in front of me.
And if you go through the analysis and it talks about what reckless homicide, and then it goes to the defense that Mr. Strand was advancing. And so the jury was informed that his defense was that this was an accident.
Okay.
But
the burdens of proof are different. And the state has to prove this,
right
beyond a reasonable. So you're looking at different burdens of proof.
Absolutely. And the way that if we go down the issue preclusion path with regard to burdens of proof, that is an element that's looked at. That's an element in the fairness analysis that's being done. And when you do look at that, if, for example, there was, let's say, a negligence verdict against Mr. Strand first, and then he was going to be tried criminally, or there was another type of civil action brought against him that had a clear and convincing standard of or burden of proof. So the first one was a fair preponderance. The second action would be clear and convincing. You could not have issue preclusion in that circumstance because the burden is higher in the second instance. And because it is higher in the second instance, it doesn't translate the same way. In this case, and this is typical that we've seen in these, in the cases, you know, the various cases, the Cronwall case, for example, that was a case where the gentleman was convicted of drunken driving and then sued his insurance company claiming he was entitled to liability benefits because he wasn't driving, okay? And so he was convicted beyond a reasonable doubt of drunken driving and then was precluded from then pursuing that civil action because of that criminal conviction, because now the same issues came in, the same operative set of facts was before that jury, and then after his conviction, he was trying to pursue a case with a lesser burden. And this is, I would say, fairly standard issue preclusion analysis.
That's not a reckless homicide where there was only one person present besides this poor, and these facts are so sad. The facts, though, I mean, what I'm hearing you say is that because the jury reached a verdict of reckless homicide, then we know what the facts are, and the facts must have been reckless, even though the only facts introduced at trial, from what I can tell from the record, are that he either accidentally dropped the baby or she accidentally fell off a table in the kitchen when he was making a bottle.
Well, I don't think those are the only facts, though. I think the facts that were advanced by the forensic experts that were employed concluded that is not likely.
If the jury concluded this was an accident, would he have been found guilty of second degree?
He would not have been.
Okay, I want to go back.
That was the defense, right?
Correct.
So she's really suing Mr. Strand, and he has insurance of State Farm, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so I don't buy this. Well, I'm still wrapping my head around what you said before. You're basically saying that a criminal conviction prevents a victim from a crime of a crime from thereafter suing someone who's been convicted, at least in this situation, which I don't think there's any case that stands for that proposition, that the verdict of the criminal case prevents her from bringing suit in a civil case. I'm not aware of such a situation. So where is that? Do you have a case site? There's certainly nothing in Wisconsin.
Is it from bringing suit or just from having insurance company against you? Does the lawsuit go on even if you aren't in it?
That's an excellent point, because I was going to get to that. What we're talking about here is issue preclusion.
Right.
Not claim preclusion.
So that's fine.
But that's an important distinction, I think, that's drawn by the various cases, because she can pursue her claim against Mr. Strand. He just doesn't have insurance to cover because of his reckless homicide. Okay.
Is there a cite to a case that you have where a criminal verdict was held, where issue preclusion took the outcome of a criminal verdict and prevented a civil victim from suing civilly? I didn't see anything on point at all.
The closest one I have is the Kranzush case.
Counsel, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Thank you. Let's take a OWI. We had a case involving OWI earlier this morning. Criminal OWI. Let's say the person is convicted of a sixth offense, drunk driving, and injures or kills someone. Is it your position that the injured party cannot find coverage under a policy? I realize it may be an auto policy, but the definitions are the same. So occurrence you look to and how you define occurrence. So is that your position? Isn't that the logical extension of your position?
That is the logical extension, but it really comes down to how the conviction occurred, okay? Because when we talk about full and fair litigation, fully litigating it, there are cases that say if you plead nolo contendere, if you plead not guilty, or guilty, I should say, that's not a full adjudication of the matter, and there's going to be a limitation on the ability to apply issue preclusion principles. If you get convicted of a crime that has as an element something that would be other than an accident, and that's precisely what we have here, because going back to that jury charge, the finding that the jury had to make in this case was that it was not an accident. In order to convict him, because the accident was tied to the awareness element of the crime.
Two things. First of all, I would find it breathtaking, but every once in a while my breath gets taken away, for good or for ill. But for this court to hold that if a sixth offense drunk driver who goes through a jury trial and gets found guilty, that would preclude the person who's injured by that from getting any coverage under an insurance policy. That's what you're advancing here.
I'm not really advancing that.
Okay.
What I am advancing is that it's going to be on a case-by-case basis that
okay,
you have
but
to...
Didn't you just say the logical extension of your argument is that?
But what I said was it depends on what the elements of the crime are.
Well, you also seem to be saying it depends on whether it's a no contest plea, and we all know that if it's a no contest plea, the ramifications of that. In my example, I said the person has been found guilty. And in that fact, and I agree it depends on the facts, and in that fact, the logical extension of your argument being found guilty of drunk driving is that there's no insurance coverage.
If it's not an accident, I'm sorry, I apologize.
No, that's okay. You answer my questions.
Yes.
I'll let others ask theirs.
If it's not an accident,
So the answer is yes to my question. Is that right?
The answer is yes if it's determined that it is not an accident. Mm-hmm.
I guess the second thing I wanted to touch upon is really what we've been discussing, whether the matter has been fully litigated, right? And that's part of it. And it seems to me, under that Page case, that the threshold question is whether the litigants were in privity and had sufficient identity of interest. I thought, and your opposing counsel argues, that after looking at the Page case, it was informative. I mean, there were a lot of similarities. So distinguish for me, if you would, please, this Page case.
Sure. And I'll go back to the direct action statute doesn't come into play at Page at all. It's not an auto-related case or an insurance-related case in that sense. What it focuses on is, and again, and I think counsel mentioned this, is the use of offensive collateral estoppel in that case. And it was grandparents that were a defendant in a civil suit that weren't defended in the criminal suit. And I think the issue really came down to whether or not there would be an ability for them to defend the negligence claims that were brought directly against them. And the difference from Page to our case is that in our case, Mr. Strand defended himself. He defended himself in that criminal action. He was able to present evidence. He crossed a four-day jury trial and was convicted of a non-accidental crime. And that's the difference. Because the focus on the grandparents in Page was negligent supervision. That was the issue. And whether or not they had a separate duty to oversee their son's activities. That's not what we're talking about in this case. And that's why Page is very distinguishable from this case in that sense. Because what you have to do is you have to ignore what happened in the underlying criminal case involving Mr. Strand, where the jury found it was not an accident, and you have to ignore the scope of the direct action statute that only allows the claimant to take to the extent that coverage is available to the tortfeasor. That's all a person can do. You can't expand that. And I think the Kranzush case talks about that and talks about other issues that are outside or extra contractual to the contract between the insured and the insurer and says you can't do that. That's third-party coverage. That's what we're talking about here. It's third-party coverage.
Counsel, can you please I'm trying to figure out how the direct action statute fits into the analytical framework here. It wasn't talked about in the Court of Appeals. You did talk about it on page 15, but it didn't feature prominently in your analysis. And so I just feel a little undereducated in terms of your theory here. And I just want to make sure I understand your argument.
Okay.
Can you just walk through how it fits into issue preclusion? Exactly what part of the analysis are you plugging this into? What work does that statute do for you? And I guess relatedly, maybe I'll ask a precursor question, which is, do you agree that this is a should be a sort of standard kind of issue preclusion analysis, or do you think something else ought to govern?
Well, I think that the court could go outside the four corners of the complaint, look at that criminal record, and determine that the jury determined it was not an accident, Mr. Strand's conviction. So answering your second question first. And so you won't have to go through the exercise of issue preclusion. But if you did go through the exercise of issue preclusion, the issue of privity features prominently, obviously, in discussion. You cite to the restatement section 85 of judgments to talk about that very issue. And the point is that doesn't deal with the direct action statute. So to the extent that there's a claim that there was somehow an inability to fully litigate this issue. And again, we have arguments in here about how Ms. Dostal was a witness, she participated in the criminal trial, et cetera, not unlike what we saw in the Jensen case. But I think most importantly is that when you look at the heart of a coverage claim or a coverage decision, you have to determine whether or not there's a triggering event that allows for a further analysis to be undertaken with regard to coverage. And in this case, our position is that because Ms. Dostal sued Mr. Strand and State Farm, direct action against State Farm. She's limited to whatever insurance benefits that Mr. Strand could recover. And since Mr. Strand can't recover any insurance benefits, neither can Ms. Dostal.
But that's not an issue preclusion analysis. That seems totally separate, doesn't it?
I don't think.
I'm just trying to figure out how it fits into the arguments, because you raised it in the context of issue preclusion. The way you just framed that, it seems like a standalone, you don't have coverage summary judgment argument. But you didn't frame it to us that way, and I'm trying to make sense of where this fits in issue preclusion, if at all.
Excuse me. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
In our briefing and in response to the argument that you have to look at Ms. Dostal's relationship to the criminal prosecution, we did argue.
And on that, your position is that a victim in a criminal case, because she is a victim under the definition of 950.04, right, that she was able to somehow litigate her claim in the criminal case, and she couldn't sit at counsel table, she wouldn't have been able to do a discovery, she wouldn't have been able to ask a single question to a single witness, she would have nothing to do with strategy. She would have done zero except get up and only answer questions that were asked of her. I mean, I just find that impossible to wrap my mind around.
Counsel, I'm responding to that. I see your orange or yellow light is on. It might benefit the court if you could discuss also the differences between a claim under the direct action statute and third-party insurance coverage.
Sure. And I'll try to do that as quickly as I can. The direct action statute obviously affords an opportunity for a claimant to go directly against a third-party insurance company like State Farm in this case, but is limited to the coverages that are available to the insured. And in this case, in a third-party liability case, let's say you just go ahead and sue a third party and you get a verdict, you could recover against their insurance company as long as it's an accident. But here it wasn't an accident. I think the jury conclusively determined it wasn't an accident, and that's what the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals hung their hats on. And so as a consequence of that, and under the direct action statute, Ms. Dostal, again, and I hate to repeat myself, but can't take anything greater than what would Mr. Strand would be entitled
to. And that's different from the hypothetical that the other Justice Bradley posed to you regarding, I believe, the drunk driver injuring somebody who would then bring a claim against the tortfeasor, and of course insurance companies, if they exist, are routinely brought into those actions.
Right. But again, if it's determined that the underlying criminal conviction was, you know, intentional or not an accident, I think we'd find ourselves at the same location.
But that's the question here. I'm sorry. I'm going to try one more time because I'm just not totally getting your argument on the direct action statute. Are you making that as a without reference to assuming that this was not an accident in the, you know, the conclusion in this case, is it a separate argument from issue preclusion? Does it inform issue preclusion? If so, where exactly does it fit in the analysis?
I think it does inform issue preclusion, and I think it fits into the privity analysis.
Okay, so it's not conclusive, it's not determinative, it's not a standalone argument. You're using that as an adjunct to your privity argument.
Well, and the way the argument, I'm out of time here.
May I finish your answer?
May I finish this? The way this works as it relates to this direct action issue is that Mr. Strand was convicted. He had certain insurance policies available to him, but because of his conviction, it wasn't an accident, and because it wasn't an accident, he doesn't recover under those insurance policies. Uh-huh. And by expanding that, you're expanding the rights of strangers to the policy beyond the scope of the policy. Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Counsel, what do you see as the triggering event for coverage under Mr. Strand's policy?
I'm not quite sure I understand your question.
Well, in order to get to coverage, you have to have something that fits within the policy that triggers coverage. So my question to you is, what is the triggering event under Mr. Strand's policy?
Based on the evidence in the record, it's a fall.
Say it again?
Based on the evidence in the record, it is a fall. That is the evidence we have in the record as to what happened and the injury-causing event.
Can you examiner completely disagreed with that characterization and said that the skull fracture and the death could not be caused by a fall.
She actually said that it could not have been caused by a fall from that height, and she actually did say that a fall could cause a skull fracture.
But the jury, beyond a reasonable doubt, not even to the level that you would have a trial on this issue, well beyond the level, they conclusively determined that this wasn't a negligent act.
Well, they found that he was criminally reckless, which is almost identical to a negligence instruction. But more importantly, with issue preclusion, that doesn't matter.
Can you address the direct this whole argument with respect to the direct action and the fact that she only stands in his shoes, and because obviously he has been convicted. He could not go to State Farm and get a claim from State Farm. And that she can only stand in his shoes according to the direct action statute. That's what I'm hearing. I'm still not understanding how that relates to privity and how that relates to all of these issues. So if you have a response to that, I would appreciate it.
Certainly. It doesn't. Talking about the Kranz case, it's been talked about a lot. There is a different procedural setup for that case. That was a bad faith claim. So that's actually a tort victim making a claim against the insurance company for the tortfeasor saying, insurance company, you acted in bad faith for refusing to settle the claim. That is a direct claim against an insurance company saying, regardless of what the insurance policy limits are or any of the terms in the policy, you did not act in good faith, and therefore I'm going to come and bring a claim against you for that particular behavior. That is a completely separate animal that we do not have in this case, and so I don't find the Kranz's case helpful.
You aren't suggesting...
Give me another example of a time when the insured could not obtain coverage, but other people can under the insured's policy. Everyone agrees, right, that the insured has no coverage here.
I don't think that that's true, because Ms. Dostal is making a claim.
No. You believe that Mr. Strand has a claim that will be covered by insurance.
I believe that there are disputes of fact that prevented summary judgment at that stage. It's possible that after a jury trial, the jury still determines that there's no coverage for this particular claim.
The claim is hers. But how would he have coverage under his own policy for this act that was determined by a jury beyond a reasonable doubt to not be an accident?
And
how would he have coverage?
And I think that that goes to the heart of this issue, is whether or not you consider what the jury determined to be determinative against Ms. Dostal.
No, I'm asking him. If he were to make a claim, how would he overcome the fact that beyond a reasonable doubt the jury determined that this was not an accident?
I think that's a different case that we don't have here. That's not the case that we have here. We
so
have
it's
her
irrelevant
seeking...
to you whether he would be covered?
I think it's a different set of circumstances that we have seen in other cases, and I think counsel
Give
mentioned.
Give me an example.
I think it was the Cromwell case, if I'm remembering
Give
correctly.
Give me a real life example. I like those.
Well, I'll just take it right from that case. I think he alleged that his friend was driving a vehicle, and the jury ended up finding that he had been driving and found him guilty of the crime. And then he went after and made a separate civil claim against his friend, and he said, no, you can't have a second bite at the apple. That would be a case where that would apply.
Please go ahead.
So it comes down to privity.
It all comes down to privity, and the direct action statute has absolutely nothing to do with privity.
Let's take a look at the contract that we have before us. This is a contract of insurance, if we want to go that route. And we have in Section 2 liability coverage. And so we know that you can sue in Wisconsin a direct action against the insurance company, but this is the words of the statute, the words of the contract I'm speaking of. Personal liability. If a claim is made or a suit is brought against an insured for damages because of bodily injury or property damage caused by an occurrence. I don't know, do you know where counsel is pointing to with regard to the direct action statute showing up in this contract of insurance?
No. And I apologize, my red light is on.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right. Let's meet and close conference at 10 to 3.